Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, where we talk about the films of 1999, hanging from a helicopter like a teabag here in 2020. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Chalisco.
And with us today is Delandra Mesa, my colleague and my friend from Step Up. She's a writer, and Delandra, you wrote on Step Up, you wrote on Z Nation. What did you write on this summer?
Black Summer.
Black Summer.
Mm-hmm. And I've written probably 13 or 14 made-for-television movies.
And that is why I wanted to be here today to talk about Lake Placid, because about 70% of them are kind of in the Lake Placid vein or so.
Blood Lake, Attack of the Killer Lampreys, Raging Cajun Redneck Gators.
Blood Lake, is that what you said?
It's called Blood Lake, not Blunt Lake.
Yeah, okay.
Blood Lake. Okay.
Blood Lake. Attack of the Killer Lampreys.
That's the same one. That's unfortunate. And then Raging Cajun Killer Gators was also retitled, right?
It was retitled to Alligator Alley, which I think
Boo.
Is not good, but what are you going to do?
What are some others?
Night of the Wild, which is about a town full of dogs attacking like a small town. Rise of the Zombies and also Zombie Night, which is kind of a follow-up. Bound, which was like our 50 Shades of Grey. Mm-hmm. What's her name from Buffy? Who plays...
You have Charisma Carpenter?
Yeah, uh-huh. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Very good in the role. A lot of Lifetime movies, things that were called things like Wuthering High School. Dreamhouse Nightmare, that kind of stuff.
So if there's anybody who knows... As we discussed briefly on text yesterday, how difficult it is to write these kind of movies, it's you.
Oh, right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that when we were watching this movie, I recognized the format of it, because all of those movies kind of have a formula. And I was like, oh, this is exactly the same formula. And I was wondering why. And then I looked it up, and it's because Sci-Fi funded all of the sequels to this movie. Mm-hmm. And so I really think my bosses heard from Sci-Fi that this was their preferred sort of, formula for feature features. And so this was the formula that I learned. So I was like, oh, I know exactly what they're doing in terms of.
So this is kind of like the grandfather of prototype, all the Sharknadoes and all the because you worked for Asylum, which is a company that did Sharknado and their many offsprings, the other, you know, storm creatures.
Yeah. They do a lot. They do a lot of what are called mockbusters.
Lavalantula.
Yes. Okay. it's a lot of stuff where it's like, it has a similar title, like Transmorphers instead of Transformers. So all of that is direct to video, but they also have a really robust sort of made for TV movie section as well. So that's where I was. It was all like mostly sci-fi, Lifetime, Element. I did one for AXS. I did one for Animal Planet, but those were the bulk of them were sort of either creature features, zombie movies, or sort of like women's thrillers. But yeah, as I was watching this, I was like, everything except the Sharknadoes, because Sharknado was kind of its own beast that ended up having its own system of development. But all of the rest of them are very heavily modeled on this. I think really it is this movie. That's what I think the genesis is.
And I would say that the entire sci-fi Asylum model picked a really good movie to base it all on. Because I think this movie is, I mean, you're going to be surprised just how good I think it is. I think this movie's tremendous. What's that?
Yeah, you told me that.
I think it's tremendous. I like it better than Deep Blue Sea, for one.
No way.
It's like not even close to me. It's not even in the same universe. I thought it was fantastic.
Don't get me wrong. I really liked it. But I guess, so since we're all TV writers, I think that it's also interesting to look at the David E. Kelly component of this a little bit. Like, I think that this feels in its own weird way, sort of like an expensive R-rated episode of Picket Fences. Like, I think that he has sort of that, the Betty White character in particular feels very much like a character out of Picket Fences. And I feel like at 82 minutes with credits, this movie's barely theatrical length. Mm-hmm. Like, I wonder if there's a longer movie here and they were just like, fuck it, let's just keep to the crocodile and let's not worry about like characters. I mean, I think that Bridget Fonda and Bill Pullman have elements of three-dimensionality, but everyone else is kind of.
I disagree. I think Oliver Platt is a well-drawn character. Part of the reason I like this so much is the tropes that they used.
Yeah.
They used really well. Like Bridget Fonda found something in the, you know, the New Yorker who's never been camping that didn't feel like every other version of that.
And I agree 100% on that.
And Oliver Platt's character in this type of movie is usually like out to sabotage the whole mission and usually winds up being the villain. And I thought
that I also agree on that.
I thought there was something really sweet about like his vulnerability and the way people, you know, seem to be drawn to him. His how wounded he seemed. I really do think it's a lot deeper than most movies like this. Like, frankly, Deep Blue Sea, which is, you know, an obvious comparison to it. It might not be as like thrilling as Deep Blue Sea, but that's not really what the movie is. The goal here is this is so stupid to say, but it's a tender movie. The goal isn't to kill the crocodile.
Well, they couldn't. I mean, I think what you're reacting to is they do a lot of scenes between the characters and there's a lot of dialogue going on. And, you know, it's very like, when I was a kid, I used to skip stones, you know, all that shit.
Sure.
To sort of like do character development. But I think that a lot of that is a function of a creature feature in which they've spent a lot of the budget on name actors and nice photography, because it looks great. Like the quality of the light and everything is so beautiful in this movie. And then they hired like at the time big names. And then I think the thing when you're doing these movies is that you're limited in the actual effects that you can do. Like when we did Killer Lampreys, we were sort of told, like, because we want to get Christopher Lloyd and we want to get sort of bigger name actors, you're going to have to take the budget for the FX down to about 50 effects for the whole movie. And when you're watching this movie, you can see that there was sort of a similar dilemma, because they definitely wanted it to look good and to look like a real serious movie from the outside. But they didn't. That means that you can't show the croc very much, which they don't. I think the croc has like 4 minutes of screen time, probably total.
Mm-hmm. Looks great, though, when you do see it.
Yeah, I love it in the end.
That's Stan.
In the water, it looks great, but out of the water, it looks a little bit like the Ghostbusters characters.
Yeah, the CGI is kind of all right. It's Stan Winston doing it.
Yeah, it is.
Who's like amazing, and the rubber croc looks so good, especially under the water.
Yes.
But I think so because you can't show the croc very much because all that shit costs money. It's like, oh well, let's get the characters talking to each other a lot more than in other action movies.
So I had to look up what a lamprey was because I didn't actually know what it was. And for people that don't know what a lamprey is, it's sort of like a eel with like more teeth, kind of.
Yeah.
which is freaky. I mean, if a bunch of those come at you, that would be really scary. I have not seen your Blood Lake, but
it's not good. But it's not good. But the best scene is Christopher Lloyd sitting on a toilet. He's the mean mayor of the town.
Sure.
And he's sitting on this toilet because you gotta go. And
even Christopher Lloyd,
a lamprey comes up and kills him through his butt. And
kills Christopher Lloyd through his butt?
Yes, and Christopher Lloyd sells the shit out of it. Like he was robbed. This was Emmy time. He was convulsing. He gave it his all. It was amazing. It was one of the proudest moments of my career. I was like, yes.
We should get that clip and put it on.
We should. We absolutely should.
Yeah.
This, I think that it's the other movie that I feel like I thought about a fair amount when I was watching this, and a little bit with the B-movies you're talking about as well, is Tremors.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because Tremors... Tremors, I think, had a bigger budget, or I certainly remember seeing the Tremors a little bit more than we see the croc in this.
Well, it was like 10 or 12 years earlier. I mean, it was different. But
yeah, but it had a similar tone to it, I felt like, that this had.
Yeah. Where it's sort of a comedy at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not shitting on this movie, Kenny, just to be clear. I think I do think that... Deep Blue Sea and this are doing, they're doing different things. Like they do exist in a similar genre to a certain degree, but like, I don't know. I mean, Rennie Harlan, and I don't even know who wrote Deep Blue Sea. I probably should know that, but like, they're two very different. There's just a very different thing. Like this to me is really much more of a David E. Kelly thing than it is a Steve Meinier thing. Like the director feels like he's at the behest of David E. Kelly's tone as opposed to the other way around, which is, Rennie Harlan is running that ship, and it's like, I'm doing a really expensive B movie.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately they are trying to do different things. And I think, as Deep Blue Sea being set on an offshore oil rig, essentially, versus Lake Placid happening in this, small town in Maine, colors the way we look at those two films. It's a much smaller film. It has a much smaller feel, but like I think the intimacy works so much better, and the relationships between the characters are to me so much more well drawn. Like another thing that I think most of these movies would have done is, by the way, I talk so much shit about English and Australians doing American accents on this podcast. I think Brendan Gleeson's is great, so. Brendan Gleeson or Oliver Platt, the movie would have picked a side, and they might have picked neither side, right? Those might have been your two villains, but they gave humanity to both of them, and that's why it mattered at the end that when Bridget Fonda kisses Brendan Gleeson on the cheek, you want that moment because he's changed, he's actually grown.
I agree with that 100%. I guess as you were talking in my head, the perfect movie would somehow be either David E. Kelly writing Deep Blue Sea or Rennie Harlan directing Lake Placid. Like there's just a part of me that feels like those, like Steve Meinier just doesn't really direct this with much of a visual flair, you know? And I would say that the script I would argue as well that Bridget Fonda and Bill Pullman as characters and Oliver Platt, I like them all a million times more than any of the characters in Deep Blue Sea, but the bombastic kind of over the top, big expensive silliness of Deep Blue Sea sells me on Deep Blue Sea, if that makes any sense.
I don't know, man. This had moments when the bear comes out of the woods and attacks them. I was sitting alone in a room and I yelled, "Holy shit, a bear!" and then the bear was eaten by the crocodile. And I go, holy shit, a crocodile! There were
That's
other times.
Character development. That's the character development that you're talking about.
That's what I'm looking for.
There were big,
wild moments. There were a lot of them. The guy's head getting bitten off. I loved it. Bridget Fonda just kept getting severed heads thrown at her. Like these,
correct.
These things all really worked for me. And I do think that there were a lot of like kind of big flashy moments that weren't so much, I don't know, not to like, it didn't feel like Reddy Harlan trying to do Michael Bay the way I felt Deep Blue Sea. By the way, I like Deep Blue Sea a lot.
I know.
Deep Blue Sea is like tons of fun. Yeah. This felt like its own thing. And like, sometimes there are movies like this, like a Lake Placid, you know, a much more obvious version of something like that is Blair Witch, where this thing comes along and isn't really of anything else. And does have like these really long tentacles that you wouldn't necessarily expect. And I think Lake Placid has, to you know, kind of Delandre's 13 credits, a long list of things that it inspired.
Can I ask you a question? Sorry.
Sure.
So just to rewind a little bit, did you see this film in 99?
No.
Or was this the first time that you've seen this movie?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I might have seen it. I mean, I might have seen it in the way, you know, but it didn't register really.
Right. Were you just because, you know, we tend to ask this of our guests, but in 99, were you a big moviegoer? Were you seeing a lot of movies? Was this on your radar at all back then?
Yeah, well, I would have been like, I graduated high school in 2000, so I would have been like 17 or something. But there was not, I mean, this is back, you know, there was nothing else to do. Like, you went to, I grew up in the country, so it was like on the weekend, you went to the town that had like a mall and a movie theater, and you went with your family, and my parents did not care what I saw whatsoever. Like, they showed me Seven when it came out. They didn't even give me any warning what we were going to see. Like, they did not give a fuck.
Mine too. That's why we're such good friends.
I know, that's why we're very like, literally we would be fired for like the jokes that we tell each other under our breath. Like, it's not good, and it's all because of the 90s and these movies that our parents subjected us to. They're terrible. So yeah.
It's so good to have you though. What would
That's I amazing. Do? So okay, I mean it does feel like Kenny, a little bit like a lot of our guests have a somewhat similar story of like the things that they were exposed to too early to some degree or another.
Do you think that has anything to do with wanting to go into this? Like, do you feel like, because I never got the sense that you were exposed to inappropriate stuff, you know, quote unquote inappropriate stuff.
Yeah, no, my mom definitely, I mean, my mom didn't care, but I also don't think, like, I mean, she showed me Lethal Weapon when I was far too young. Like, I think that violence was certainly kind of like she didn't seem to really care. Sex stuff, I think, for the most part, I was a little bit more shielded from. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's, you have to wonder whether or not if a kid is either exposed to something quite young or shielded from something quite young, if that in some way or another points them in the direction of the field that they go into. But I mean, hard to say.
I think a lot of it has to do with your brain just starts to understand the rhythm. And particularly because we grew up in a time where there were these sort of high concept blockbusters that weren't necessarily based on something else, which Lake Placid is kind of one of the last like gasps of.
Yeah.
I think because we were just exposed to this very specific, and I think if you watch this movie, you'll recognize this very specific style of like high concept, really slick. The beats are just come really fast and sort of furious, and you know exactly the point of every single beat. And I think when you're raised watching a lot of that, your brain just starts to understand how to turn a scene sort of automatically, and the length of a scene and the rhythms of it. That's what I've always thought, is this, my parental neglect, you know, led me to understand the rhythms of a scene.
It's true. It does become internal like a clock.
And, you know, it's Delandra and I think we're similar, and we kind of let our kids watch some shit. Because, like, you know, we've run out of shit, I think. Yeah. I let Rollins watch Die Hard last night. Any thoughts on that, guys? That's how far gone I am.
You just don't care at this point.
But I'm just so far gone. Like, I mean, I ran through Fast and Furious during the pandemic, and it's, where do you go from there? So
yeah.
I would be interested, and not to, you know, totally put you on the spot to lunch, but I would be interested, as we go through the plot of this movie, if you could kind of, you know, do what you can to break down what you're talking about, the ways in which, like, this formula is, you know, maybe, I guess, not overlaid onto this film, because it's kind of, you know, where it, you know, the genesis of it, but what you see that they've done that you've adapted, or that others can adapt in making a movie like this.
Oh yeah, I can tell you. Yeah, absolutely. I can tell you exactly, like, what it is they're trying to do.
I think there's also something to be said, speaking of formula, because it does feel like we should talk a little bit about the David E. Kelley component as well. I mean, this is a guy who wrote in 1999 by himself, I mean, or at least the drafts himself, over 100 episodes of television and 2 features within the course of a year.
Horrifying. It's a
truly, truly insane thing. And, you know, it's, he obviously had a formula. He obviously had a way that he was doing things. You know, he had a room for his shows anyway that were, you know, they were cultivating ideas for him, and then he'd go off and he'd write it. So they'd come up with an idea for an episode, and then he'd go off and actually write the thing. And it would kind of slot into his, I mean, he was writing, for lack of a better way of putting it, he was writing procedural television, right? He was writing legal dramas, or he was writing, you know, stuff that, or even cop shows with Picket Fences that felt, that sort of fell into a structure. So I'm to your point, I think that this movie falls into a structure as well, that he easily kind of slots his, you know, type of characters into. I mean, I think that Bill Pullman feels a lot like Tom Skerritt. Bridget Fonda feels in her own way a little bit Ally McBeally.
Yep,
like, there's exactly. definitely feelings there.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I feel like this is him having seen Tremors and Jurassic Park and going, I could do that. And, you know, and then sort of throwing in Ally McBeal, exactly like you said. I thought so much about, like, it actually made me think a lot about the character of Ally McBeal and this sort of neurotic woman character that now it seems a little played out. But at the time it was considered like, wow, an unlikable female character. Wow. You know,
yep.
It was subversive.
Well, it's interesting, too. I mean, in some of the reading I did, apparently Bridget Fonda was offered the role of Ally McBeal and turned it down because she wanted to focus on films. And then obviously the David E. Kelley connection, I'm assuming, gets her the role in this to some degree or another. She would have been a great Ally McBeal. I mean, I think she would have been fantastic. I think that, you know, Kenny and I texted a little bit about this, but Bridget Fonda just never really getting her due in her time and not getting the roles that maybe she should have got. And then kind of just stops acting.
Yeah, Bridget Fonda brings something to this kind of character that I feel like I don't see that often. It doesn't feel like she's putting it on. You know, like I feel like it's not a very natural role for a lot of actors to find themselves in. I think you have to have a certain level of confidence and assertiveness to be an actor. And Delange, you're an actor, you could obviously, or you've been an actor, you can speak more to this than I can. But it does feel like she found this. Like this wavelength within this movie, that I didn't feel she was unlikable at all. Like I felt like she was like really rootable from the beginning, and she didn't, like, she wasn't just a wilting violet the way you might think this character might be. She stood up to the sheriff, she stood up to Bill Pullman, and she didn't do it in such a way that kind of made her, you know, rude or not understanding that it's not her turf. She didn't take things personally. I really kind of like the way she played this, and I like the way the character was written.
I think he's drawing, it reminded me a lot of sort of a Meg Ryan character in a way. Yep. And I was like, I feel like I can feel him drawing from that. I can feel him drawing sort of from like an Annie Hall type character. It's sort of, you can see what movies he was watching and was thinking, these are the sorts of women I find interesting, which again, at the time was subversive. And I think they at the time did complain, like, oh, this is an quote unquote unlikable character, simply because she wasn't, you know, the wilting flower, and she wasn't, you know, gained for everything that I wanted to do. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Kenny and I have talked about this, but I'm not sure on what episode it was, but we talked a little bit, and I don't know if you remember this, Delandra, but the I think it was a cover of Newsweek or cover of Time, basically talking about the evolution of feminism, and it showed like the faces of the different women, and then you had Ally McBeal there, and how kind of crazy it is to think about that then, and how groundbreaking that character was at the time, you know, and it's I quite liked Ally McBeal, you know, at some point. I'm sure we'll talk about it in some form or another. It holds up kind of. It sort of doesn't in other ways, in lots of ways it doesn't. But it is interesting to see David E. Kelley having a little bit of a resurgence. Big Little Lies was obviously a very big show. He was not necessarily the person that I would have thought to adapt that material. But I thought he did a, you know, a, I don't know, the script for Big Little Lies was not that amazing to me. I think that what makes Big Little Lies, you know, watchable is these movie stars and this director and sort of the HBO-ness of it, and less about the David E. Kelley component. But Delandre, it does feel like he's having a moment.
Did you have feelings about that?
I really
about
liked
what? Oh, yeah.
The first season. I really liked. And I had read the book, and to me, actually, the best things about it are the things that were in the original book and less sort of what the show brought to it. I feel like that author brings such an interesting sense of like setting up unfairness at the beginning of it that makes you want to see a fair resolution by the end, and you'll kind of hang in there to see it. I liked it, especially the first season, the second season less so.
You know, Laura, it's funny. Laura read the book too, and I think Laura liked it more than I did. I watched every episode of both seasons, so I certainly don't dislike it. And I didn't hate the second season, I think, as much as everyone else, because I loved what they did with Laura Dern so much. And I just found her shit so fucking watchable and awesome and interesting and fun. And you know, that felt like a really cool arc to me. But I was so... Was this in the book, Delandre? Was the framing device where they kept going back to this, the interrogations part of the book in any sense?
I believe it was. I read it a while ago, but I believe that it was. It was pretty... It was actually fairly accurate to the book, except for like a few setting things. But yeah, I believe it was.
It took place in Australia in the book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you, Phil. Like, I wouldn't... David E. Kelley was not only not the right... You know, not the expected choice, because it's not necessarily his obvious... It's the obvious material for him to adapt, nor is he probably the right choice, considering, you know, he's a 65-year-old man. But he also wasn't very hot. Like, he had been cold as shit for about 15 years. He was still getting stuff made, but it wasn't buzzy stuff, and it wasn't stuff that was particularly well received. Like, there was a Robin Williams show that was not particularly well received, and I think he's Goliath, right? Which has some critical renown, but not really.
He's Goliath, yeah.
Not really. And then he had a bunch of other things that just, like, you know, didn't work, like the Wonder Woman adaptation that's almost like become a meme and a joke. Oof. In culture. So it's interesting that they went to him, but I do think that, you know, some people, especially younger people, don't understand like how revolutionary he was, you know, even going back before the 90s. When you go back to LA Law, like, LA Law is a completely different type of law show, and it was the biggest show in the country for a, you know, long period of time, and he was in his 20s and he was writing every episode of that. So he's, you know, he's a pretty remarkable TV writer, I guess screenwriter, but yeah.
I would also just to, you know, to kind of, close the loop on David E. Kelley, there's a part of me too, watching this, that felt like he does have a very kind of specific voice. It's almost Sorkin-esque in its way.
Yeah.
Of sort of this, the way that his characters speak, they have this, they're very smart. They're very kind of witty.
Very sarcastic.
Very sarcastic. And the casting in this movie, specifically with Bill Pullman, Bridget Fonda, and Oliver Platt, they all understand how to deliver his dialogue, which is specific in its own way. There's a specifically vague kind of broadcasty component to him that feels elevated enough that you don't feel like you're just watching a run-of-the-mill broadcast show. But at the, you know what I mean? Like, there's this sort of intellectualism that he brings to it, not as far as Sorkin does, where everyone has to sound like they're, you know, the most brilliant person in the world, but they do seem elevated. I don't know if you felt that too, Delandra.
I felt like, yeah, there's like a snappiness to it. But there's a lot of dick jokes. I feel like he, yeah. I feel like he was in a way like, cool, I want to get into this other genre because yeah. it gives me an excuse to kind of like make my characters a little more like potty mouthed. And there's like a yeah. lot of focus on sex and then a lot of focus on men pointing out that women are women. Just pointing it out, just being like, you have boobs.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
Oliver literally says that at one point, like, you have boobs. Yeah.
He does. He straight up says to Meredith Salinger, yeah. I think you have boobs.
You have boobs is literally what he says.
Yeah, you have boobs.
And then at another point, they're like, oh, this is like a period. You'd know about that, huh?
Yeah.
So it's just, but like a lot. It's not even just those two examples. It's sort of constant, which is also part of just that's how things were written back then. That's very much a product of its time. But I do feel the sense of him being a little like giddy to get into that kind
totally,
of dialogue.
Totally.
That's a really good point and observation. You know, the worst movie we did was this movie Love Stinks. Delandra, are you familiar with it?
No, I'm not.
It's the worst movie. It stars French Stewart as a super successful TV writer who's super
I love
mean.
French Stewart.
You won't after this movie. Who's super terrible to his girl, who to his like fiance Bridget Wilson. But he's a TV writer and they have a few scenes set in the writer's room and the jokes the writers make are so awful and foul and misogynistic. And they're not the jokes for air, if that makes sense. They're the jokes mm-hmm. that they just make sitting around the room. Phil is holding up the DVD cover for Love Stinks right now.
Just so that Delandra can see it in its glory.
Oh, wait. I can't see it. Hold on.
Oh,
yes.
You remember
that? Friend. Oh, that's so 90s. Look at that.
Yeah.
Everything about it.
Everything it's about it. And Tyra Banks has like three lines, but gets like top billing. So it reminds me, to your point, because I never considered this, you know, when I was watching the movie, it does remind me of the jokes writers would make in the room that they know wouldn't get on air.
Yep.
And like to your point, it does seem like he there's this part in Curb Your Enthusiasm when Julia Louis-Dreyfus was going to do a show with Larry for HBO, well before Veep. And she goes, I want to say fuck. Like I want to be on TV and say fuck. There's a little bit of that, right?
Yeah. She, yep.
Like David Kelly's like, all right, enough of this. I want to say fuck. And you know what I want even more? I want Betty White to say cocksucker. That's what I really want, which she says. So
she does it very well. She delivers.
She's tremendous. Yeah. Is this the beginning of the Betty White is a foul-mouthed old lady thing?
I guess.
I think so. That's a pretty big deal, too. You got to give him credit.
I do agree that the movie has tentacles, like you said. It has some far-reaching influence that I think was really subliminal.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really does. So I'm going to give a synopsis for the people that haven't seen Lake Placid, just a little bit of context. When a mysterious creature violently kills a man in a Maine lake, Jack Wells, played by Bill Pullman, the local game warden, looks into a bizarre case along with Sheriff Hank Coe, I think that's how you say his name, played by Brendan Gleeson, and visiting paleontologist Kelly Scott, played by Bridget Fonda. Looking for clues in a tooth that the beast left behind, Kelly and others eventually locate a monster, a massive, vicious reptile eager to devour anything in its path. Can the crocodile-like creature be stopped? It's written by David E. Kelly, directed by Steve Miner. It came out on July 16th, 1999, in second place with $10.9 million behind Eyes Wide Shut and ahead of The Wood and Muppets from Space. It would go on to make $56.9 million worldwide on a $30 million budget. It would also spawn 5 sequels, mm-hmm. Lake Placid 2, Lake Placid 3, Lake Placid The Final Chapter, Lake Placid versus Anaconda, and Lake Placid Legacy. It has 46% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 36% from audiences.
Lake Placid versus Anaconda, I like. I like the idea that the monster is now called Lake Placid.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. It's like a body of water versus body a giant water, snake.
Yeah, that's we.
Well, and to get into it, the lake is called Lake Placid.
No, it's not. That's true.
It's not.
Black Lake.
It's called Black Lake.
They wanted to call it Lake Placid. I love that. That is adorable to me. That's so funny.
But they named the whole movie, and they literally just have one line where they're like, "We wanted to name it Lake Placid, but it was taken."
So they went with Black Lake.
Okay.
I just want to read quickly a snippets of a couple reviews to give a little bit of the critical response to the movie. Roger Ebert said, whether the movie was intended at any point to be a serious monster thriller, I cannot say. It is in its present form, it is an uneasy compromise between a gore fest and a comedy, sort of a failed Anaconda. The movie is pretty bad.
Failed Anaconda.
But the movie is pretty bad, all right, but it has a certain charm. It's so completely wrongheaded from beginning to end that it develops a doomed fascination. We can watch it switching tones within a single scene, sometimes between lines of dialogue. Yeah. It's gruesome and then camp and then satirical and then sociological. And then it pauses for a little witty intellectual repartee. Occasionally, the crocodile leaps out of the water and snatches victims from the shore, looking uncannily like a very big green product from the factory where they make Barney toys. This is bad. It's a stupid review. This is the kind of movie that actually discussed in long. It's a stupid review. I'm going to read one other, two of the really quick ones. The Dissolve said, at the time Lake Placid was made, Kelly, who happens to be born in Maine, was the undisputed king of the banter-filled hour-long procedural with Chicago Hope, The Practice, Ally McBeal, all in some phase of their successful runs. Kelly could be described as a very busy man and a very lazy man. Busy because he had 3 shows and 2 movies. Mystery Alaska was the other one, which we'll cover eventually. Going at once. Lazy because they all sounded more or less the same. Though Lake Placid was directed by Steve Miner, whose credits include Friday the 13th movies, the second and third, and Halloween H2O, it's a writer's movie, though, through and through, and Miner serves more as a house director, as he occasionally did for Kelly on Chicago Hope and The Practice. It's neither Jaws scary nor Tremors funny, but genre movie fans in 1999 did have a chance to feast on the year's talkiest, most neurotic horror movie.
Maybe that's why I like it. A talking neurotic horror movie.
It is very neurotic, yeah.
Yeah.
It seems kind of horror. It does seem to some extent like the kind of horror movie that people who don't love horror but think they love horror might make. Does that make sense?
Totally.
Because it's not scary per se.
What is?
I mean, some things are, but definitely not this one. but there is some decent like gore, which is fun, and there's some decent tension, mostly involving the animals themselves. I felt less tension with the humans and more tension when it was like a cow being dangled or something. I was like, ugh. But and the underwater scenes were really good.
They could have done a little more with that one scene when Bridget Fonda falls into the water.
That scene was so lame.
That is, you know, that's a money scene. You know, that scene you're kind of waiting for all movie. And it turned out she was being chased by Bill Pullman, I think.
I wanted to sort of just piggyback on what you were saying, Delandra, about the underwater stuff, because I did think it looked really great. And part of it has to do with what a lake looks like underwater and what an ocean or a sea looks like underwater. Mm. It's green and murky, and you can't really see very far away from your actual light sources. So it really creates a really, which you don't see a lot, just a very eerie, I mean, I guess maybe the Friday the 13th movies because they had lakes in them, but that sort of that dark black, I mean, I went to summer camp and I hated swimming in the lake because it's so dark and so black and you don't know what's going on under there. That's true. I think they did a good job with that in this.
It's like fog. I mean, it's the same effect as if you know, the girl running from the werewolf in a foggy forest. Yeah. It's the same effect because in fact, there's a great scene where she is sort of hiding behind a tree underwater.
Yes.
It's like surrounded by all the silt and the dirt and the creatures coming towards her. And then it misses eating her because the tree's in the way.
It's great.
It's just a great scene. And it looks that robot or animatronic or whatever they use looks fantastic in that scene.
There's a great wide shot at one point where you see her sandwiched in between the jaws with the tree. And it's a really good shot. It's a really good scene. I mean, I got to say, I think the crocodile effects by and large were pretty impressive. I mean, it's a $30 million budget. So you don't see it as much as maybe they probably would have liked. But when you do get some nice wides of it, it's pretty impressive. I mean, it's got some... I mean,
in
there's
the water,
that scene...
I would just say in the water, it looks amazing. And out of the water...
You didn't like the scene at the end when it gets up on the beach and you get that really wide...
I just thought it looked, you know, three, fake. Four, five levels below Jurassic Park.
I mean, puppets, they look better than CGI. Yeah. They just hold up better. Yeah. Over time.
And I'm sure it was a puppet that they had in the helicopter at the end, and that looked great. Yeah. Like tremendous. Yeah. Like loved. I mean, look, I loved the ending of this movie. I thought it was so great, really clever, unexpected. Yeah. You know, they brought all the elements together. I really liked the way they wrapped it up, and it would have bothered me if it looked terrible. So I don't think it looked terrible.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I also want to underline what you were saying earlier because I agree with it. A lot. This isn't a movie where the crocodile is, it's not binary that he's the villain, if that makes any sense. Like they really do anthropomorphize the crocodile in a, like you genuinely feel bad for it when it's trapped in the helicopter at the end. You don't want them to kill this thing. And that is antithetical to most movies that are made like this, right? Like more times than not, it's like, kill the fucking thing that's trying to kill people. And surprisingly, this movie doesn't really go there. It tries to have its cake and eat it too by blowing up another crocodile that shows up out of nowhere.
Yeah. which to me is almost funny. Like I think that was played as a gag. I think particularly with Oliver Platt's last line to Brandon Gleeson and his response, you know, did you feel good getting to shoot your big gun? He said it was overrated. But which is great, which I think was great. I think you're supposed to kind of interrogate yourself and your own bloodlust. I think you do see this in a lot of movies where one that I remember was Super 8. Do you guys remember Super 8, the J.J. Abrams movie?
Yeah.
Where at the end of it, they, you know, there's kind of this weird kinship between the monsters and the kids, but it doesn't quite feel the same as when you have two of your four major characters who are actively trying to save this monster from the beginning. Like that is their stated goal. And I don't think Bill Pullman's stated goal is really to destroy it. His goal is safety. And Brandon Gleeson's goal is safety ultimately. Right. So it does feel to me humane from the start in a way that like Anaconda isn't and Congo isn't. And these other movies
and Jaws aren't.
There's no, yes, Jaws
you
is
don't,
an evil.
You're like, kill the fucking shark. Kill the shark. You know what I mean? Like, there's, I think there's also something interesting to, because I think Super 8's a really good movie to point at, because I think that Super 8 also very much struggles with wanting the monster to be scary and also wanting you to care about the monster at the end. So when it does get to go home at the end, you get your ET component of like, oh, he's getting to go home. But it never successfully makes that transition. It's better when it's scary and we don't really understand it. And then when we kind of do understand it, we're just like, what? Like, I don't really know what I'm supposed to take away from it. This movie does a better job and admittedly has quite frankly, lower goals, right? Like, it's not striving to do, like, Super 8 was definitely JJ's attempt to really take a swing. And you know, it was his kind of his blank check movie after the Star Trek movie. So it certainly felt like he had put a lot more on his shoulders. This movie succeeds better because I think its bar is lower.
Yeah.
There's also, if I remember correctly, at the time, environmentalism, sort of a pat.
Yes.
Let's recycle and let's conserve the environment. That was sort of a popular theme, and it wasn't really considered political at that time. It was just like, oh, everyone should like not, you know, kill the owls.
Just don't.
Yeah. You know? So I think that's a little bit of that influence as well. As well as, again, little shades of Jurassic Park. Again, the sort of feeling of
totally. Like,
the beast itself is so wondrous. Why would we get rid of it? Mm-hmm. Although I think the dinosaurs held up a little better in Jurassic Park.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, I think funny. Also, Kenny, your point about Oliver Platt's character, because when he swoops in on the helicopter, it has a very Jurassic Park vibe, right? Like, this is the guy, this is the money, this is, and the fact that the movie zigs instead of zags, you know what I mean? That it does something to deconstruct and turn that trope on its head, it deserves credit for that too. Like, that it takes that character and makes that person, to your point, three-dimensional, and not another villain or a human villain, I think is really smart.
Very Jeff Goldblum inspired. Yes. You know?
In so many of these movies, that character is a play on Marlon Brando from Apocalypse Now. A crazy wild man who is either going to kill all the people because he's protecting nature or going to kill all the animals because he's, you know, afraid of the nature that he probably made. But this just, like, Delange, did you watch the Five Bloods?
No, not yet.
I'm not giving much away by saying that there's, you know, there is a group of characters who are there to find mines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who are trying to, you know, what's the word? To dig up and
neutralize
mines. Mm-hmm. And you know, the main leader of that group is like a very wealthy young woman from, I think, Belgium. And obviously the Five Bloods is trying to be somewhat realistic in its portrayal of, you know, post-war Vietnam. I think that there's a realism to Oliver Platt's character. That I respected, and I don't really need to see another John Voight come down and making everyone's life hell for no real good reason. So,
yeah, I can see that, but I don't think he pulled off the necklaces.
The funny thing is, I almost always hate Oliver Platt. I think he's always used like terribly, and there's something about
really?
Him here. Yeah, I mean, he was in a horrible movie we watched this year, 3 to 10.
That was
right?
A terrible movie. Yeah, yeah.
The
movie
and he was used to terrible effect, and he often is used to terrible effect. But there's something about him here that I feel like they tapped into his base humanity.
I'm trying to think. I'm looking up Oliver Platt because I'm trying to think of like what because I love him in The West Wing. I liked him in Flatliners, but I'm trying to think of like what other things.
Was he in Murphy Brown? Was he in Murphy Brown?
No, I think that's what's his face?
Is that Miles something?
No, are you talking about her like handyman painter guy? Like
Oliver Platt?
No, was what's that guy's name? Like, God damn it, I can't remember his name. But yeah, Oliver Platt. I don't know. I like him. I'm always happy when he shows up.
I think everybody likes him. I think I'm in the minority here, but I don't know. I don't know. You ever see a movie called Digstown? Phil, I've mentioned it on the podcast before. He's in that. Great in that.
It's a very 90s cast. It's very 90s. Like, this is like Bill Pullman. They were really trying to make Bill Pullman happen. They really thought we wanted to fuck Bill Pullman in the 90s. I don't. Imagine that squinty face just creeping over you. Like,
I, I, um,
I don't know. I saw while we were sleeping. I think you're supposed to want to fuck Bill Pullman, just in general.
Yes.
He goes, while you're sleeping, where he was, to me, very hot. And then he's the president of the United States in the next movie.
Is that Dave?
In Independence Day. He's the sexiest president of all time.
Yeah.
Former fighter pilot. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I thought women are totally about fucking Bill Pullman and men.
I think there's also something to the previous Bill Pullman Bridget Fonda connection, which was Singles. So they're in that together, and he plays the plastic surgeon that almost gives her a boob job.
That's a very good point.
And they're great. I think they have two scenes in that movie together. They have legitimately great chemistry. I mean, their scenes together in this are great. You know, they elevate the material. They seem to genuinely like each other. You just feel like they enjoy being. And that goes a long way.
I love the ending of it. I mean, you know, I love Does No One in Maine Make a Move?
Yeah, it's a great
one. So much better than
which is true.
In Maine.
I don't know Maine, but I know small towns, and you'll die before someone makes a move on you in a small town. You'll literally. They're all religious. Together, you know.
That's the line of the podcast. You'll die before anyone will make a move on you in a small town.
Even at the end, this guy's like, "You want to just get a beer?" It's like, "Come on."
Yeah, I know. He doesn't even.
So he puts his bag in between them.
and then he has the nerve to like complain that she's the one who had to have the ball sack to hit on him, and then he's like, "I think I preferred the croc." It's like, you know, fucking Bill Pullman. Like, honestly,
give him a break. He's probably a virgin. So, I mean,
those teeth clattering against yours. I don't know.
This is our second Bill Pullman movie. This is our second Bill Pullman movie of 99. We had another Fox 2000 movie, actually, which this is actually I want to talk really quickly just about Fox 2000, which in 1999. Yeah, this batch of movies is insane. Broke Down Palace, Never Been Kissed, Ravenous, Pushing Tin, Fight Club, Light It Up, Anywhere But Here, Anna and the King, and Lake Placid. Like, that is a murderer's row of weird fucking movies.
He was in all of them?
No. He was only in Broke Down Palace and this.
Okay.
But I'm talking about the company that produced this, Fox 2000, which was the studio that produced this. It's a weird group of movies.
It's a murderer's row of never wases. Like, almost every movie you mentioned had very high aspirations, and the only one that kind of got there was Fight Club, right?
It failed at the time.
It definitely failed at the box office and didn't get any Oscar love. I mean, I think we've done a lot of those movies, and we think a lot of those movies are actually like quite good.
Quite good.
But they were all misses. They were all like Anywhere But Here is a very good movie that was a big Oscar play that didn't get any notice.
Yep. I mean, Anna and the King was as we talked about on our episode, was a very expensive failure. You know, this is a movie that honestly, like you look at this roster of films and most of them, quite honestly, are kind of expensive. You know, Broke Down Palace, Anna and the King, Never Been Kissed. I mean, I guess, I don't know. It's a weird batch of films, but this movie.
They're all in like the 30 to 60 range. I mean, except for Anna and the King and Fight Club.
Yes.
They're all like in that. They're all in that range of movies that don't get made anymore, right? The things that we're always whining about that they don't make these mid-budget movies, it's because of Fox 2000's 1999 roster. That's what ruined it.
It kind of is, truthfully. It's one of those, like, all of those movies had movie stars in them. All of those movies had opportunities to break through, and just all of them did either fine or poorly. And that's the reason why, you know, we might be where we are. And Bill Pullman is kind of the perfect mascot of that. Of, like, the guy that, like, people seem to like, I guess, in a dad sort of way. But, like, to Delandre's point, like, no one really wanted to fuck him. He's kind of everyone.
Come
always
on, these guys are crazy.
he gets mistaken for Bill Paxton all the time.
Do people want to fuck Bill Paxton?
I don't know.
I'm trying to picture Bill Paxton. I know. Wait. All I can picture is Bill Pullman. That's the thing.
Twister.
Yeah, Twister.
Bill can only picture Bill Pullman.
He's twisting.
So. Oh, wait. Yes. Okay. No, you know, actually, I met him in person because I used to work for his manager, Bill Paxton. And I believe he would bring muffin baskets sometimes. Oh. So, yeah.
Fast fit a girl's heart. Yeah. So cool. There's one other thing that kind of that this brings up to me. To your point about Bill Pullman being the mascot for that type of movie, that type of star doesn't exist anymore. The mid-budget star, right? The we still have the same 30 movie stars we had 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. We've made a few new ones, I guess, but they're all very young. You know, I don't know, who's a new movie star, Tom Holland or something.
Sure. Same Star-Lord.
Yes, yep. And then
Six
Chris's. No joke. I mean, it's like six Chris's and a few others. But if you haven't played a movie star and you're not, you're not someone who has been nominated for Oscars, which I guess is another way to kind of get your name out there, because, Bill Pullman wasn't starring in these big movies and Bill Pullman wasn't getting nominated for Oscars. There is no Bill Pullman thing anymore. There is no, star in a movie or two movies a year as either, the lead of a smaller budget movie, the romantic interest in a bigger budget movie, and we're talking about, this is tons of guys like Bill Pullman, Bill Paxman. Also, I think Dennis Quaid falls into this. I think Domer Mulroney falls into this. I think that there are, Kyle MacLachlan falls into this to some extent. There are a lot of these guys and women who just don't really have a path to stardom. And, it's not inconsequential for the business or for these people, starring in a TV show, procedural show or a show on a cable network just does not have the same prestige or the same legs as it used to have. And also those roles generally go to people who were movie stars 5, 6, 10 years ago.
Do movies have the same prestige?
No, they don't.
I don't think they do. I think now it used to be that if you were on a TV show, people were kind of nice for you. Good for you. Now that's sort of, if you're not on a TV show, it's like, what's wrong? Who hates you?
I think part of that also has to do with, and I'm not telling you guys anything you don't already know, but your smaller orders, your limiteds, your miniseries, your what have yous make that a real possibility for a Cate Blanchett to do a Miss America or whatever. So it really just it put TV on the map in that way. Plus, if we're also being honest, movies don't have the characters in movies might not have the depth that they used to now that franchises are everything. So I guess it's where we're at.
I know it sounds kind of frothy and, meaningless, but it's not meaningless that now I know that there are tons and tons of television shows, but Reese Witherspoon stars in 3 of them. Julie Roberts is going to star in 2 of them. Meryl Streep is doing the Knicks and just did Big Little Lies. These roles that used to go Nicole Kidman starring in 2 of them. These roles that used to go to up and coming actors or character actors, Desperate Housewives had 5 character actors or 5 journeyman women who wound up playing these lead roles. I mean, and Eva Longoria was on her way up, but 4. Now, if you cast Desperate Housewives today, it would be 5 stars from the late 90s. You have Sarah Michelle Gellar in there, maybe. So how do you make new stars now?
Yeah.
It's a very good question. I mean, it does seem as though broadcast doesn't seem to get movie stars. And I think part of that tends to be the fact that broadcast still longs for the days of doing 22 episodes. I mean, if they can, they're still going to try. Streaming and cable, I think you're more likely to get, a prestigious name or a movie star to do it. Because it would,
they might also be wise to what I think is the fact that they don't sell the show that well. Particularly on network, a show for instance, Blind Spot doesn't have a star in it. Blind Spot is, about to do its 100th episode.
That's a show?
There you go.
I never heard of that show.
Blind Spot is the show about the girl who wakes up with the tattoos all over her body. And they're like, where are these tattoos from? What are these tattoos? So, and I don't even know the star of the show, and she was all over billboards 5 years ago. But I don't think that movie stardom is so important. I guess that to some extent might be the answer of how you create new stars. But again, we don't know who these people are. A young, attractive actress who starred in a show like Blindspot, say Evangeline Lilly, 15 years ago, goes on to have a career and become like kind of a name actor to some extent in Hollywood. But, you know, none of us can name this actor. And Delandre didn't even know the show existed. No. So,
I mean, I would argue, too, that there's something to be said for the fact that there is still a chasm between a person who watches broadcast television, who might not have some crazy deep cable package, who might not even have, you know, broadband. You know, there are people, you know, that are watching procedural television on your major networks that are just completely kind of in their own bubble. Do you know what I mean? And there are people that I mean,
for sure.
Blindspot just had its series finale last night, in fact. But, you know, it went for 4 or 5 seasons. It's syndicated around the world. And those procedural shows still translate all around the world because of the formula, right? Like, it's easy to have Hawaii 5-0 in Romania or whatever because they get the fucking gist of it. And your streaming cable shows just don't really do that. So I think there's still a pretty big sort of separation between those two worlds. And I think that will still exist for at least 10 or 15 more years.
I agree with you.
But anyway,
formula. Let's break down.
Yeah. Let's talk about the plot of Lake Placid, shall we? Basically, you know, the movie opens in a very Jaws-esque way with Brendan Gleeson on a boat with his buddy, Walt, who's scuba diving in Black Lake. He's attacked by an unknown creature and bitten in half. It's pretty gory right out of the gate. Like,
So creature feature movies, you're going to want to start with a bang every time. And so you are, speaking of formula, almost all of these movies will begin in the first 10 minutes with some sort of attack, some sort of something exciting, but it is very unlikely that you'll see the creature because they don't have the budget for that. And so most movies in this genre, they're going to wait until about a midpoint of the movie before they actually reveal the monster, which is why you get a lot of these scenes where the tension is built through bubbles on the water, sounds underwater, things that are tied to it. And like you said, the beginning of it is very Jaws reminiscent in that shot where he's sort of like,
yeah.
The creature's got him from the bottom and he's flailing around on the top. Yeah, it's very Jaws reminiscent, but I think in a good way. I think it's effective.
I want to ask even a more basic question. Can you define creature feature?
I mean, a creature feature is anything where the monster is a creature, whether that's usually not zombies. Zombies is kind of its own genre, although you could lump it in, but mostly it means like creature from the Black Lagoon, animals that are going crazy, monsters, that kind of thing. Zombies a little bit its own beast. Mm-hmm. And then usually, what I was told when I first started working for the Asylum, they kind of gave me the list of what sci-fi like to see in their creature features. And it was basically, you start off with a bang. They love females as the main characters because you get to see boobs. But also, it's more okay for women to be a little more vulnerable at the beginning and to have that shift happen, mm-hmm. which they sort of do very, you know, they do that in this movie with this character too. And then the other rule is you need something every 10 minutes. There has to be a scare. In the Asylum, they want someone dead. There has to be someone dead every 10 minutes. In this movie, you can see to a minute, they almost, there's some sort of either jump scare or there's a gore moment, like when they find the toe or whatever.
Yep.
So they pace that out about every 10 minutes.
That's really interesting. It does feel like you've got your scare up top, your Jaws-esque hiding mm-hmm. the creature, and then immediately you're introduced to your scientist, essentially, right? The person who is going to try to get to the bottom of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
In this version, it's It's a paleontologist who works at the American Museum of Natural History.
Yeah, I didn't really get that, but that's fine.
It's fine, but here's what's weird. Later on, she's like all icky about, I don't want to be camping. But I was thinking, like, out of all this, wouldn't you think a paleontologist has been camping before? Like, that made no sense to me.
That is kind of what they do on the digs.
Right. Don't they camp? It doesn't make any sense. And she's like, I've never been camping before. What's a tent? Like, okay. I don't like.
There's also, to your point, this whole setup to Kelly's character is kind of fumbled a little bit, if we're being honest. She basically works at a museum. She's working for her boss and dating her boss, played by Adam Arkin, you know, the hottest guy in town.
Yeah.
And he's,
I mean,
fucking her friend. They break up. She finds out that her best friend, or whatever friend's Mariska Hargitay, is sleeping with him, and then he sends her into the field because the girlfriend wants to get rid of her or something like that. It's a very strange setup.
And they found a tooth.
Yeah.
So they're like, there's a tooth, there's a dinosaur tooth, so you have to go check it out. But they didn't contact like the police department or anything, apparently, or they did. It was very unclear, like, did they know she was coming or not? Because they're giving her a lot of leeway, but like bitching about it the whole time.
It's an odd tee up to her character, but once we get her there, I'm on board. It's just a little, and I actually sensed maybe in this portion of it, the most editing weirdness. Like it all kind of felt janky. It never really kind of flowed. I was just like, what's going on here? And then they're like, just get her to the fucking lake.
Well, that's the other thing is in these setups, one of the other sort of formula rules is the hero has to say no to the mission. Which mm-hmm. she does quite vehemently a few times. And then they sort of treat that jump cut like a joke, sort of. It's like a funny cut that like, oh, but now she's there. And then one of the other rules is like at the end of the first act, which is a little different because these, you know, when I was writing for TV, you're literally writing acts with commercial breaks in between. But at the end of the first act, it's literally like, and now we're doing the mission. It's like, now the mission will begin. And so they very cleanly, in some ways, set this up, although the logic of it is like, what, a tooth and an affair? Okay.
Yeah.
The insight you're giving makes this a lot more clear to me that I think David E. Kelly was trying to adhere to this formula, but he was really trying to keep his David E. Kelly-ness, right?
Yeah.
Like that's so much of what Law and Order is. Was Law and Order was these people have interior lives. These people love people. These people get cheated on. These people have wants and desires and et cetera, et cetera. And he was trying to do all that in the course of about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And it didn't work very well. I agree with that. I also don't care that much. But
like you forget about it quickly. Like we never go back to it. So, you know, who cares? Then they basically go and talk to Betty White because they see that – sorry – they go talk to Betty White apropos of essentially nothing.
Yeah, why did they go?
They go talk to Betty White because she's, I guess she lives on the lake, and they figure we'll just go talk to Betty White. And then she explains that she euthanized her husband with a skillet.
Which is weird because they keep rolling, like the sheriff is rolling his eyes at this story, but you'd think he'd be interested.
In murder?
In the murder. The sheriff. He's like, okay, you killed your husband with a skillet. It's like, well,
whatever.
On? Like, where is he?
That was great.
So that happens, and then
that by the way, is like that's a very David E. Kelly-ish kind of move too.
100%
in like Boston Legal, over and over and over in David E. Kelly shows, the least likely murderer matter-of-factly murders someone and gets off for it for being like an unlikely murderer. You know, like that would happen over and over again. I think his ethos is kind of like, at some point, just let them murder. You know? Well,
And also, this kind of comes back to the picket fences thing and the Twin Peaksy kind of thing that he's going for. He's going for kind of this like quirky pseudo David Lynchy kind of thing. Obviously, not real David Lynch, but like that odd sense of humor that exists with like people in small towns.
I get
and, like,
that Rome the weird Wisconsin things they do. Thing you're talking about, though. Like, yeah, which you know, to me, adds to the charm because we're not taking this movie that seriously. I have another question, Delandra, about the Betty White character. Is that an archetypal character for these type of movies?
It doesn't need to be, but I have written, I think in Zombie Night, Florence Henderson played our sort of old lady, foul-mouthed old lady. She was blind in ours, so it was like, oh, blind with zombies, you know, was the idea of the tension. But usually they're there to sort of add to like, oh no, your town's being overrun by dogs or whatever, and your old grandma's trapped in the house with one. How's that going to play out? I guess it plays out sort of the same way as a kid, you know, would, which is interesting because they don't really use her that way in this movie. They sort of subvert that.
I was just going to say, they kind of, again, you know, an acknowledgement to David E. Kelly trying to usurp any tropes or at least try to kind of, you know, play with them a little bit. She obviously, and as we'll later learn, is I guess the mother of these crocodiles.
Mother of crocs.
She loves them.
Yeah.
So she kind of gets to be foul-mouthed granny, which is a little bit of a groundbreaking thing at the time. Plus, she also gets to be sort of this puppet master of the situation as well, which also kind of breaks some tropes.
She literally, I guess, fed her. Well, I don't, spoilers, she literally fed her husband to the croc, which I was like,
but I don't know if she fed him to him,
she buried
but like
him.
It seemed like what I happened was the croc was going to try to eat his horse, so he got in the way of that and he got eaten by the crocodile,
right?
And then she buried, I guess, what was left of him.
It was very confusing, and I refused to rewind the movie at any point.
Right.
So there was that
reasonable.
There is something I want to touch on that maybe you guys didn't notice, but it's the hair in this movie. And it's the way, first of all, the highlights are incredible in this movie. Like, this is classic, and it could have gone wrong because just a few, 3 or 4 years down the road, you had the skunky chunky highlights, but in this movie, look, they're beautiful, classic highlights in their hairs. And then, but really the story to pay attention to here is the French twist that what's her name wears throughout the movie, like in the beginning of the movie, to signify, first of all, that she's a sexy scientist, but also that she's uptight.
Yeah.
Because
her hair's back.
Yeah. Her hairdo's very uptight in a very 90s sort of Sharon Stone way. And then through the course of the movie, her hair becomes looser. It's like half up. When she's more vulnerable, and then by the end of the movie, she's been thoroughly sexified, and her hair is just down. So I'm just if you want to know her emotional, like where she is emotionally in her art, you pay attention to the hair.
That's amazing. That's
just good work.
Her hair tells a story.
It does.
It tells a journey. Yeah. At this point, Hector shows up, played by Oliver Platt. He's this mythology professor enthusiast, shows up in a helicopter.
That's our second straight white guy named Hector, Phil.
Yeah, that is true. That is true.
I can't support this. No.
So it's interesting because there's two moments when Bridget goes in the water. There's the first where the canoe gets flipped. And she's in the water for a minute or so, and then they get her. Like, I think they do a hard cut out of the lake. Like, we don't actually see her get back in the boat. And then later, she's kicked out of the metal boat that they're in. And that's the longer sequence, to your point, that doesn't really build any tension.
And
she's in the water twice.
She doesn't swim. She's literally.
Yeah, she sits there. Yeah.
Like, I was like, we established she couldn't swim earlier. I don't understand. She's literally just like, my ass would be kicking so hard to get to the other side of this lake. And she's just like, They do it later too, when in the big like ending scene, just standing there like an idiot. I don't know.
Yeah. She swims and also, in the end, right? In the end.
But that's the other thing. He tells her to go under the water. Under in the water. My mind, I'm like, can't the croc swim faster than you? Like, right. Going under the water is creating less resistance. I mean, I don't know.
I don't know. I trust Oliver Platt. He knows his stuff. but in the first one, she has, well, the second one, I guess, she has the life jacket on too, which I think Delandra might be on some hair shit where she goes from needing this life preserver to not later, you know?
At some point,
she finds her ability to take some care hair shit. Yeah, the hair shit is real. There's no question. You've convinced me that that was absolutely intentional.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
This hair person was on it. And like across the board, these small town hicks have amazing hair.
Yeah, well, all of them. Every stylist has to start somewhere before they get to the big city.
Yep. So then Jack and Hector scuba dive in the lake looking for the crocodile. But we don't find anything, basically. But then when they come up, one of my favorite moments, they come up and Burke, one of Hank's deputies, has his head bitten off by the crocodile. It's a great moment, even if it seems scientifically impossible and I'm not entirely sure how it all works. And there's a splash of water that basically makes it so we can't see anything, but...
You ever have a hard time like biting into something and you have to use your molars?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of what the croc did. He went and molared it. Now he got the head off. So it would be easier.
Okay, sure.
I just realized something, and I want to ask you, Delandra, how obviously it was intentional, but how much of a trope this is and how much of a an unusual thing it is. Because a movie like this, usually, I think, as your protagonist, this female protagonist, your love interest, and your wacky third.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the love interest normally would have encapsulated the traits of Bill Pullman's character and of Brendan Gleeson's character. Right? Is that you, Phil?
I don't hear. Who's hear that?
Sheriff? Oh, that's me. Sorry, there's some sort of helicopter.
You want to okay, yeah, that's fine. I just wasn't sure what was going on.
Sorry, my cat is like, what the hell?
All right.
So I'll
start from like the Bill Pullman part. So usually I think this character would have encapsulated the traits of the Bill Pullman character and the Brendan Gleeson character, the sheriff. And looking at this movie, my sense is Bill Pullman doesn't actually have a ton to do except for fall in love with Bridget Fonda. Because Brendan Gleeson is given all the pathos, right? He's the one who has the point of view on this. He's the one who is protecting his town and his town's people. He's the one who, you know, is kind of looking at all these people a little side-eyed and has his troops to protect. Whereas, and not to, you know, argue against this movie, which I love so much, but what is Phil Pullman's purpose here? I mean, I understand that he's a fish and game inspector or whatever, but what is his narrative purpose?
He has no arc, by the way. No storyline, no arc.
I believe he's supposed to be this sort of strong, silent type who's never wrong. And this is where I think he's a little miscast, because his sort of squinty, like, yeah, oh, there's crocs out there. You know, it's that kind of vibe where he's supposed to be like the manly man. And I just don't buy it as much, and that's why I feel like his role seems smaller than it should inherently feel.
It does. But
also I would say mostly the trope in these movies is to have as many characters as possible, because you need someone to kill every 10 minutes. And that is something I noticed, especially in the back end of this movie, they don't really do. There's very few,
almost no one dies in this movie.
No.
The guy dies in the beginning, the guy gets his head bit off, and a bear dies.
Yeah, and the few people who die, you don't really know them at all. And the main characters are held very close to our hearts, I guess. Because, see, in usually how these movies would go is you would sort of winnow everyone down to the last two, which I assume would be the two, you know, the two lovers, at the end. And in this movie, they chose not to do that. In this movie, they chose to keep everyone alive, maybe sort of a Jurassic Park style.
I think they thought this was the beginning of a franchise, too.
Yeah.
It certainly felt like...
You kill everybody in franchises of this nature. You leave one person alive, usually, or two or three. But
it's true.
I mean, everything you said is true, and everything you said I agree with. And I think that there's a reason for that. I do think that, you know, you ultimately didn't want this to be about a serial killing crocodile. You just wanted it to be about, like, for instance, he doesn't kill Oliver Platt after he's had a meal of a cow, right? He's not just a bloodlusting crazy killer like you'd have in so many movies like this who can't eat enough. Like Jaws couldn't eat enough.
Right.
But I feel like there might've been, and I'm not, you know, knowing nothing, there might've been a draft of this where there wasn't both these characters, Bill Pullman and Brendan Gleeson. And they almost separated out like the good traits and they gave them to Bill Pullman. Mm-hmm. And the negative traits, and they gave it to Brendan Gleeson. And he has his arc, right?
Yeah.
And that kind of feels like because they wanted to do so many things with the sheriff character that you'd have a hard time doing with your romantic lead. Like they want him to punch Oliver Platt in the face for no real good reason, which was hilarious and would have been a lot less hilarious if it was, you know, the handsome Uber male, not that Bill Pullman is that, but that's the intention,
that's what he's meant,
I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If the handsome Uber male was picking on the, you know, the chubby science guy like that. So I think that they, and I think it was to great effect. Like, I think the Brendan Gleeson Oliver Platt dynamic was this really strong secondary, you know, romance. I mean, you know, in its own way that didn't step on the initial one. But yeah, a side effect of that, a casualty of that, was Bill Pullman's character development, which there was almost.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because it does feel like at this point we have that the bear attack crocodile thing, which you mentioned earlier, we talked about, but Jack gets wounded in that, and you have sort of this trope of Kelly stitching him up, the woman stitching up the man who's been injured or whatever, and it's a nice scene, but again, it really sort of underlines that Jack has no character. Like they're talking there about stuff that is really just sort of a little bit of romance or a little bit of romantic tension, but there isn't anything for him to talk about. Like he's not actually grappling with anything. It's kind of weird.
Yeah. Even she earlier had, remember I was sort of making fun of her pebble skipping monologue, which is very tropey, but at least it was like some sort of insight into her, and the intention is to make her vulnerable. I assume that this was meant to make Bill Pullman vulnerable. But see, it's different because of the way he looks with that Easter Island statue face and like his little weakling body. Sorry about that. Because imagine he's not a right cast for this either, but imagine it with like an Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right.
She's this little willowy scientist who's suddenly close to this hulking manly man with his shirt off, who's being vulnerable, his big muscly arms, she's stitching him up or whatever. It's very big Beauty and the Beast sort of a moment. I think that's the intention of the scene, but because it's Bill Pullman, it's sort of like, yeah, of course you'd have to patch him up. Like it's Bill Pullman.
Yeah. Just don't rip his, don't rip his flimsy skin. But
right.
You know, to your point, Delandra, the guy who plays this role nowadays in these type of movies is The Rock. You know, this is a very similar kind of four-person setup to Jumanji in its own way. And, you know, I think that that's an interesting thing. And The Rock always the blessing and the curse of The Rock is he always only gets the good characteristics.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You never give him, you know, any kind of pathos or any kind of deviousness, because that's just, it's hard to buy.
It's a very, these sorts of movie trope as well. If you look at the Sharknado movies, which are also Asylum, the male characters are, they always have to be right. They always have to have a plan. They're always infallible for the most part, unless they get like a little ding on their arm that a cute girl has to patch up for them. That's basically it. But whereas female characters are allowed a little bit more, not always. I mean, the badass female character is its own sort of thing as well, but can play a little bit more with like, oh, but also she's a mother, or, oh, also she has this fear of whatever. Whereas the male characters are not afforded that.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I mean, the more you talk about Bill Pullman, Delandre, the more I agree with you that he's just not right for this. Like, he doesn't exude what you need from this hero in a weird way. I like Bill Pullman, and I don't hate him in the role, but it does feel like something's missing. And to your point, Kenny, that splitting the character essentially in two hurts Jack's character.
It hurts him. I mean, you're left with, you know, it's this Arnold Schwarzenegger, Danny DeVito thing where Arnold Schwarzenegger got all the great stuff and Danny DeVito got the leftover shit. That's kind of what it feels like. But Danny DeVito's the more interesting character, right, in Twins. And the leftover shit is a much more interesting place to start than all the good stuff. I do wonder, do you guys have any 1999 ideas of who might be a better choice?
That's a good question.
Arnold Schwarzenegger is not right, but it's that type. Do you know what I mean?
To throw it out there. Now, again, he's not the right thing either, but you put Bruce Willis in the role and it becomes a completely different type of character.
Completely different.
And I do think that there is, you know, part of the reason why The Rock works so well is the reason you want movie stars is because half the work is done for you, right? You know exactly what Bruce Willis is bringing to the role, and unless it's actively stated that it's something different, like in The Sixth Sense, you pretty much know what you're working with. Bill Pullman, you're right. You really you don't know what you're getting here. You could be getting the plastic surgeon from Singles, or you could be getting the President of the United States. So you do have to do a little more work when you have someone with such an ill-defined movie star persona.
Well, I don't think it's his fault. I just really think he was sort of, you know, not cast exactly to type. And I think that probably David E. Kelly wanted that juxtaposition. He was like, let's make a more sort of modern feeling man and not such a big hulking he beast sort of type. But then the character doesn't make sense in a way because he's not that type. So
it's also a budget thing too.
What if he had Dylan McDermott in the role? Would that have been better?
If he bulked up, maybe. I don't know. No, and I don't mean it in terms of like that's the only type of man that I want to see. I just think it's the type that they were writing towards. That's all.
Yeah, it's a very strange because it's a weird movie because of where it's existing in its budget. You know, it's got like a $30 million budget. Most of it's going to your special effects. And so you're not going to be spending a lot of money on your cast. And Bill Pullman and Bridget Fonda are recognizable names, and you just hope that people show up. I don't necessarily think that Bill is completely wrong. I mean, I don't know who else you put in it that gets you any cachet at the price point that they were looking at is kind of what it comes down to.
Yeah,
you
know, I can see why they chose him. P.S. Just want to say, go ahead.
Just in Deep Blue Sea, this character, this, you know, the person who kind of fills this role is Thomas Jane, who's very similar to Bill Pullman, but way rougher around the edges. And he might have been a better, you know, pulled out of a hat type actor for this. I do think he works a little better than Bill Pullman does, but I'm sorry.
I agree.
I was just going to say that, you know, around this point, this is interesting because it's right before the big reveal of the monster. And it is about a midway point through the movie before they reveal it with the bear moment is when you first see it and you're like, whoa. But before that is the decapitation scene. And then it goes into this scene of Jane Fonda being traumatized. This is our
trauma bonding
scene. Yep. And this is meant to be the turning point in her character where she becomes sort of like more open and less uptight. And her face in these scenes is so good.
Like, so good.
It's really a great, the scene's okay, but her acting it, she has this like little, like muskratty face in a good way, you know, where she like, and then these big eyes, and she just looks so traumatized in that moment. And I guess because it's meant to be like, then the hero, the male hero, is to envelop her, you know, sees her vulnerability and is attracted by that. But she just plays the shit out of it.
I remember I thought the exact same thing in that scene where I was like, she is giving this so much more than perhaps it deserves. You know, she's just fucking bringing it. Her eyes just welled with tears, like just at that perfect breaking point, and also being able to land the joke, because it's essentially a joke where he's like, are you okay? And you can tell by the look on her face that she's not. And then she's like, yeah, no. Like she's able to kind of juggle that tone in that moment. It's really it's special.
And then
so at this point we're back to Betty White. We find out what's happened, which is she's using cows to lure the crocs, essentially, or feed the crocs. We learn about the fact that her husband kind of got killed in a melee between a horse and that crocodile or some shit. When asked about it, she says to Bill Pullman, if I had a dick, this is where I'd tell you to suck it. And then he puts her on house arrest and she says, thank you, officer, fuck meat.
She hates cops. She hates cops.
Yeah, ACAB, baby.
Yeah.
If I had a dick, this is where I'd tell you to suck it.
Like, wow.
There was a run in the mid-2000s. Yeah. Nobody would remember this but me. Where female characters on network television were saying, suck it, over and over and over again. Like, I remember distinctly Julie Bowen on Modern Family saying, suck it. And it does feel like this might have been another tentacle of Blake Blasted, the first instance of a... an otherwise unassuming female character telling someone to suck their non-existent dick. But, a door just blew open.
It was a point in culture where they were like, women can be like men. Like, there's some, you know, it was a very like macho point in culture where it was cool to be super like dickish, especially about women. And also in this movie about like homosexuals, there's like a gay joke that doesn't age well here too.
No.
So that sort of machismo is like very prevalent in that time period. And I think at the time it was like, oh, this is women stepping up and being just like the boys, and you can suck their dick too, you know? Whereas now the idea is more like, well, we're different, but equal, you know, we have other body parts that are also equal to that. But at the time, I think it was like very shocking and sort of revolutionary.
DeLon, did you feel as a female writer in rooms that the expectation to take this all the grain of salt, but to talk like a man has changed or not? Because I know that existed 10, 15 years ago, where there was a certain expectation to talk like one of the boys.
Yeah.
Or to kind of outboy the boys.
Yes. I remember when I was, especially in college, that was very much the vibe, was to try to outgross the boys, to make, you know, you made the like tits jokes yourself before the boys could make them in order to be accepted. And then even as a young writer, I remember thinking that showrunners and co-EPs would often listen, like be able to process the way white men pitched in a way that seemed faster and more effective than the way everyone else pitched. And I think it's very much just a residual of that, you know, of that sort of very like white male, this is the way we speak. And it's sort of, but it is changing. And I've felt the change a lot. And I think now there's much more credence given to be yourself, bring your own voice to the room. You don't have to speak the way that the white guy in the room next to you does. And that's not even to denigrate the way that white guys speak. It's just that was sort of like the norm, you know, that was considered like normal. whereas everything else was an outlier. And now we're entering this, like, I think really exciting for me phase. Where that's becoming a little passe, that idea that everyone has to speak that way. But the 90s are very much that way. And you can tell the way that even the women are written in this. They're very like, go along with the joke, go along with,
right.
You know, sort of like, oh, you have big boobies. And the woman in that scene doesn't respond to that whatsoever. It's just like, yeah, I'm down for that.
Speaking of that, there is a ridiculous moment. So at this point, basically, Hector and what is her name? Deputy Sharon Gare, whatever.
It's Meredith Salad.
They go on his helicopter, and he wants to go survey the area where the crocodile is, or whatever. And he's going to get in the water, and she says to him, "Don't get in the water. I'll have sex with you if you don't get in the water."
This whole scene is so dumb. It's literally just an excuse to get another character in the water when there's no reason why any of them would get in the water at this point. It's just literally like, he's crazy. He wants to go swim with the croc and face his deity. They kind of have this storyline with him that, like, he believes in the deity of crocodiles, I guess. So then...
So do I, kind of, by the way, but, you know.
Sure, that's the ultimate judge and maker, so... So there's that. So it literally, to me, is just like, it's the kind of shit the asylum, like, I would have written this scene, where it's just somebody being like, I don't know, I'm gonna go swim with it, you know? You need a body to get in there. Usually it'd be like drunken teenagers or something, who are like, fuck these crocs, you know? And they would just get in the water and get eaten. And instead, but here's the thing, is by this point, I had already realized they're not killing any of these characters, so it just deflates all the tension, because I already know they're not going to kill this asshole, and probably they're not going to kill anybody else. I was a little worried for the woman in that scene. I thought they might do a sort of mean-spirited, like, it comes out and chomps her, but they didn't do that either. And in a way, I feel like as they're ramping up to the ending of the movie, they deflate it by not allowing enough lives to be lost. Like, Oliver Platt getting eaten would have been a good moment. It just would have.
It feels like this whole sequence of him going in the water and whatever, which, by the way, looks great. Like, again, the rubber croc, like the actual croc in the water, stuff looks great. Felt like an excuse to have the croc take a bite out of the helicopter. Like, it grabs hold of it in its jaws for a second, and you get a nice money shot of, like, the croc coming out of the water and grabbing the helicopter. But, like, that's kind of the whole point of the sequence. And then we basically, now we have sort of, we're in kind of the end game, in the sense of they're luring the crocodile. They're trying to find it. They're dangling a cow from the helicopter in the middle of the night to try to lure the croc to come.
It's more effective than the Oliver Platt sequences, because you literally are, first of all, this is, like, ballsy of them, because cows are expensive. I don't know if you've ever bought a cow, but I have. Okay.
Amazing.
So, first of all, that's just like, okay, cool, great. But then also, like, cows are very snuggly creatures. They love to cuddle. They're kind of like big dogs in a way.
You grew up with cows, right?
Yeah, we raised a cow. We raised some livestock. So, and we had an orchard too. But we would just raise these livestock for our own personal meat for the rest of the year. But we stopped raising cows because we got one. And first of all, they're expensive. But two, you really become attached because they're so cute. And they come to you when you call them, and they want to snuggle. And my father said when he had to slaughter the cow that he cried, because the cow was looking at him with its big brown eyes going,
I could never do it.
Yeah. So he was like, no cows, we're only doing sheep because sheep are dumb. So So I was super tense. And also, this is a real cow, and you can tell they're really dunking it. This is not a CGI cow. This is a real cow. They're really dunking in the water. And when they finally let that cow into the water, I literally, this is the only moment in the whole movie where I was like, no, like, you dicks. I think I shouted, you dicks, why'd you do that?
You thought they were going to kill the cow.
They did kill the cow. The cow dropped into the water.
Oh, the different cow. That no, cow shows up at the end. That cow walks by in the last scene. In the last moment, that cow is free and just walk. It's awesome. Yeah, he's just a freak out. Now the one that Betty White blindfolds
that and leads to its death.
I can't speak to that poor cow. But it should.
Because the cow doesn't work as bait is the whole point. Yeah. Like they dangle it and the croc won't come for the cow. And Hector has a great line where he says, "This cow disappoints me," which I appreciate.
It is such a good looking scene. I mean, it's just at night, like it looks so cool. I love obviously it's a very hi-fi movie to some extent, but these lo-fi solutions are fucking awesome. You know,
totally
cow dangling from a helicopter. Like I this is why this is just a step above like Deep Blue Sea in the end. In the end, Deep Blue Sea was about, you know, almost like robot sharks, like they were genetically engineered sharks that you were supposed to think were like almost demonic in their creation. And you desperately wanted them to be blown up.
Yep.
And if it weren't for the charm of LL Cool J, you might not feel so great about it. But they're these lo-fi, like, you know, country solutions really work for me.
But they also have some of these moments where they're trying to build the tension where it's just like, come on, man. Like when Hector is in the water and he's like, don't shoot at the croc because the bullet might not penetrate its hide.
Not great.
What the fucking reason is that?
Give it a shot.
It might not work, so don't do it. Just let me get And then later they shoot it anyway. So it was just really weird. Like they were trying to create this tension because they didn't want to actually do, you know, what they should have done, I think, which is let some of these characters get killed off. Oh, I also wanted to say, we kind of jumped over it, but I noticed it is that when they get the head, the decapitated head, and then the snake comes out of the mouth, this is a classic. Like, it's what usually happens is they'll make a head and then they'll realize it doesn't look as good as they thought it could, which it does
distract you.
And then this is classic move is like put something, either a spider or a snake inside of it and let it crawl out to just so that people go, they still get, you still get the gore moment. So I can tell that Stan Winston looked at it and was like, we got to get a snake in there.
How about
that's so funny.
How about the bear moment? Like, what's your feeling about that?
It was awesome.
No duh. It was all, but in terms of you like that was your midpoint turn, right? That's when you saw the monster.
And
go ahead.
That's the moment where it's the first time you really see the full monster, is that moment. So again, it's the sort of thing that usually it would be a person, but they needed something to stand in for a person because they didn't really want to lose any of their main characters. And so they have this bear, which is a great solution because it looked sick as hell when it comes out. And also, I will say again, in your theory that this movie inspired, Asylum did, I mean, a lot of movies that were animals versus animals. I don't know if that was inspired by this necessarily, or, you know, the creature feature genre in general likes to do that. But it was a very like classic moment and it sounded and looked great.
It looked great in Deep Blue Sea. That was Samuel Jackson, right? That was that moment. And it was iconic, and it still is iconic. And I'm always in favor of a kill of a major movie star in these movies early on. But then again, you don't have to do it in every movie. Like, I think there is value in not necessarily giving the kill every 10 minutes or even kill every act thing here. I liked keeping the team together. It was like a change of pace, I guess. I don't know.
I think I also want to say too, because I keep comparing the movies in my head because they do make sense to be compared to Deep Blue Sea and this. And I think that this movie's climax is better than the Deep Blue Sea climax for sure. The Deep Blue Sea climax is it's all during the day. It's outside. It kind of is. The movie doesn't pay off particularly well at the end.
They also kill the female lead out of spite.
Yeah, because she tested poorly and they were like, let's just kill her. So like, it's not great. Deep Blue Sea does a lot of things well and a lot of things poorly. So does this film. But this film at least understands, like, go big, go home at the end. It all looks great at night. It all has a practical quality to it as well. I mean, one of the dings against Deep Blue Sea is it's a lot of CG going on in that. This movie has, as you mentioned, Delandra, there's a lot of practical shark work. Mm-hmm. Practical croc work in this. It just feels a lot more tactile than Deep Blue Sea does. And that really goes a long way towards not just giving more thrills, but also more of an emotional attachment to the things that are going on in front of you. So I think that Lake Placid sticks the landing better than Deep Blue Sea does in the end.
It's also naturalistic in a way that Deep Blue Sea never can be, because it's techie, which necessarily puts a barrier between the audience.
Totally.
Sorry, Delandra.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Well, I will say this sort of ending climax is very Asylum, in that it starts off with this sort of Jurassic Park style chase with the truck. And then it goes into this like very Asylum climax where people are just kind of standing in place, like around the scene while the monster does the CGI thing in the middle. And you can tell that the director was like, I don't know what it's going to look like, so just stand in your places and we're going to see the eyes here. And like, I've written so many movies. Night of the Wild was one where Night of the Wild was one that was sort of out of pocket for the genre because it's about a town full of dogs attacking people. Normally, as happens in this movie, the animals don't die in movies because people become very more concerned about the animals and more angry about that death than they will about the human deaths. And so normally the rule is you never let an animal die on screen. Whereas now, actually in big horror movies, they kill the dog all the time. But at the time, that was the rule. And in the one that I wrote, I was like, you guys, we can't do a dog movie because we're low budget and the dogs have to be trained to do things. And dogs that are trained can only do one thing. That's it. They either jump or they bark or they sit, and that's it. That's all we can do. So it was just a movie of people being like, ah, and then they cut to a dog being like, burp. And then they
I'd like to watch that one.
Which I warned them, I was like, we can't pull off this movie. And they were like, bigger scenes, more dogs, the dogs, personalities. I was like, none of that's going to happen. And it didn't. So it didn't work very well. But you can see the same thing happening here where they're like, we don't know what the CGI is going to look like. So just stand in your places and we'll cut it so that it looks like you're doing stuff, but they don't look like they're doing stuff.
I also want to sort of, I want to get your thoughts. And I wonder if this is part of the Asylum thing too, which is what you would say sort of the coda, not even the coda, the like the dot, dot, dot ellipse to future movie. Like it's not wrapped up. You've got Betty White at the very end, basically feeding breadcrumbs to a bunch of baby sharks, baby crocs, that is. And then I'm still not entirely sure what my takeaway is supposed to be of that shot of the croc on the back of a truck while the credits were playing. I was just like, what are we doing?
Could you imagine driving down the freeway and seeing that next to you?
Yeah, that'd be awesome. One time I saw a clown on the freeway, like in a clown car. It was the best.
That's thing. Terrifying.
Just a single clown?
It was just a single clown in full clown makeup in a clown car. Just
like
driving
it's
down
just one of us.
Yes. It was the best day of my life. It was amazing.
Seems like they're opening it up to a franchise essentially at the end.
They are, and they're also again letting you know as an audience that the animals are okay. Like, people are dead, but all the animals are fine. I missed the cow with still being alive. So that actually clinches that for me, that that's what they were trying to do. And also, the crocs will live on because Betty White is keeping them alive with her very expensive cows and bread, I guess. The idea of these movies is generally that you do the death every 10 minutes. People are kind of fucking around for the most part, doing tense things like hiding. And then there's the all is lost moment at the end, which they don't really do here. There's not really a moment where you're like, oh my God, everything's fucked. Like in an Asylum movie, everyone would be dead except the two leads, and they'd be like, their backs against the wall. There's no force. And then something stupid would happen, Like, you know, some Deus Ex Machina shit would happen. In this one, they don't do that. But then the other rule is, like, once that climax is over, get the fuck out of that movie. Like, like literally, I think Rise of the Zombies is like, they lift off in the helicopter and the movie's fucking done. That's it. Because it's over.
That's amazing.
Yeah. We're doing the Messenger later today. I guess we did it last week. That's a climax, get the fuck out of the movie.
Yeah, no, it'll be, I guess, technically 2 weeks ago. But I gotta say, like, I'm curious to hear your rating on this, Kenny, because I want to rate it because I want to get Delandra's thoughts on what we're doing next week. But
I want to do a quick trivia question.
Okay.
In Lake Placid 2, they don't bring Betty White back.
Correct.
You know the answer to this? You know who plays?
I don't. All right. I just know she's not in the next
one. They don't bring her back. They bring back a character with the same last name. I presume it's like her sister, Sadie Bickerman. Who do you think played Sadie Bickerman? Who might play Sadie Bickerman?
Oh, boy.
Because I was going to bring her up earlier as the other older lady that they tried to make a foul mouth queen. But I don't think it works quite as well as Betty White.
Florence Henderson?
Not Florence Henderson. I think she would probably be the one in the third.
Mm-hmm.
I think you go.
I'm drawing a blank on her name.
Betty White, this person, Florence Henderson.
Cloris Leachman.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That was the name I couldn't find. It was on the tip of my tongue. Yeah.
That's who you have to go to.
Yeah,
it's kind of like who else? There's no one else, right? It's like you go to her or you go make the movie.
Yeah, that's right. Well,
Cloris would be the lady with the meatballs from The Wedding Singer.
Yes. Yes.
That little lady.
Hip hop. Hippity hip hop. Was that Gloria Stewart?
It was not Gloria Stewart.
But that was a lady who was like a popular, like, she's not the voice of Snow White, but something like that, maybe.
Oh.
In that era, you know?
I think I stumbled upon a Gloria Stewart movie from when she was younger recently, like looking through those HBO Max Criterion movies.
Mm-hmm.
Which happens.
So Delandra, on this podcast, we rate the movies at the end, where from 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, 99 being the highest. And if you saw it in 99, which it sounds like you didn't, or around 99, we rate it then we rate it before we did this podcast, and then we rate it at the end after the podcast, as though the podcast might have changed your opinion in one way or the other. So I'll go first just to give you a sense of how this goes. But basically, I saw this in 99. I saw it in the theater. I honestly remember nothing about it. Like, I remember there was a shark. I remember Betty White. But, like, I saw it in the theater, and it was just sort of a shrug. I probably would have given it a 65 in 99. Like, I didn't hate it. I didn't – whatever. Before this podcast, I got to be honest, I hadn't – there wasn't a lot of movement for me. I got to, like, 68. It really didn't really do much for me. The podcast, however, has made me like this movie more. Kenny, you made some very valid arguments on his behalf. So I'm giving it a 74. I feel as though it's a good, better movie than I was giving it credit for. I can't break 80 on this thing. It's just that's not going to happen. But I know Kenny probably will. But that's where I'm at. So you go ahead, Kenny.
I never saw this movie before this podcast. Going into this podcast, I gave it an 85. And I'm sadly going to have to backtrack a little bit on that uber high rating. And Delandra pointed out how silly it was for me to take it that seriously and how many moments just didn't work that well. I think I was blinded by my love for Bridget Fonda and my attraction to Bill Pullman. I'm going to backtrack just a little bit. I'm going to go to a 79. I think breaking 80 is fucking insane for Lake Placid. but I do look forward to seeing, where it ranks on my, my year. And
so do I.
My film chart. So, Delancia.
And by the way, speaking of that, Kenny, I could see maybe Bridget getting into my top five for best actress. Like, I think she's fucking great.
On
this
52 in review, she might make it for me too. And you know what else might make it? The screenplay. We'll see. It hasn't been the best 52 until recently. But like,
that's actually very, very true.
Delancia, What's how would you rank it before? You'd never seen this movie before, so before this podcast and then after the podcast.
Okay, well, I might have seen it when it came out, but if I did, I don't remember, so it didn't make any register there. But so before the pod, I think my opinion holds pretty steady. I would give it a 65 before, because I feel like, because I recognize the tropes of it so much, I enjoyed watching it to see how they either went with the formula or deviated from it. And that made it, I thought, a sort of stimulating watch. And I feel like they were trying to be subversive for the time. And so I totally give them credit for that. Although it's clunky now, in terms of especially like the sex jokes, the dick jokes, the period jokes, like the gay jokes. It's a little bit like when I'm, you know, sure. But I can see what they were going for. So I appreciate that. And I would think even after the podcast, I think it's about, it holds steady in that like 65 zone, I think. But I do think, I do appreciate it really, I think, set the standard for those sort of sci-fi creature feature movies that were really popular, you know, subsequently to this.
Yeah, I fully agree. I mean, I think that, I mean, I liked it a lot more, and I really do believe that this conversation has certainly changed my perspective on the film for the better, you know. But so
yeah, I think if you have it above 80, you are you're troubled. So I can't quite do that.
Next week we have Michael Natale coming on to talk about Pokemon, the first movie, which came out in 99, and then there was Pokemon 2000, which was, I guess, released in 99 overseas, but didn't come out until 2000 here. So we're gonna stick with the first movie.
The first movie. We're going to do it the right way. Yeah.
I know nothing about Pokemon. I went to see Detective Pikachu. That's as much as I know about the series. I think Pikachu's very cute. I like him when he talks like Ryan Reynolds. But that's all I know. What are your thoughts, Delandra, on Pokemon?
I'm very familiar with Pokemon. I was not a fan growing up, but my son loves Pokemon. So I have seen all the movies you just talked about. And I can tell you that you enjoy Detective Pikachu more for having seen Pokemon, the first movie, because it's very referential to this movie. The movie is quite a ride. You're in for
I'm excited.
I've actually seen this movie as well, because I have a child who's very into Pokemon. And I agree. We had a conversation with Jessica Ellis, what was it, last week or something like that?
Yes.
About this same thing. And, you know, I do think that Detective Pikachu's failing was that it was for people who had some baseline understanding of Pokemon. Mewtwo makes no sense in the world without having some understanding of what this thing is. So I actually, Phil, you're going to be shocked. I think you're going to be shocked at what you watch. I can't wait.
Yeah, the emotional turn in this movie makes zero sense, and yet somehow emotionally, it's satisfying.
So I'm going to do something right now, which we've never done before, Kenny, which is I'm going to eat my words and say that next week is actually not Pokemon. Next week is Entrapment. And Entrapment leads into Pokemon, which is why we were talking about Pokemon with Jessica. So,
well, at
I'm
least
thrilled that we got Delandra's perspective on Pokemon.
Pokemon in 2 weeks.
That's what I'm saying. Do you remember, but I'd love to hear, do you remember the movie Entrapment? Does that mean anything to you, Delandra? Yeah.
Not at all.
You'll remember the gift, Delandra, of Catherine Zeta-Jones' ass going underneath a laser.
What you thought looked like a laser, but is actually,
It's actually a piece of string.
It's basically a Sean Connery is a sort of a thief, and they work together to like steal some shit. It's not a good movie, but we had Jessica Ellis, who is a tremendous guest, who was our guest for Anna and the King. So she came on to talk about Entrapment with us. So that's actually what's next week. But the following week, you guys can look forward to Pokemon coming out after Entrapment.
Yeah. And so, next week,
my apologies for Entrapment.
It's a great episode. Jessica's an amazing.
It's a great episode. We do a really deep dive into Catherine Zeta-Jones and whether or not is she a good actor or is she not a good actor.
Do you have a feeling on that, Delandra? Just a little preview. I'm not going to tell our thoughts, but yours.
Yeah.
I love Catherine Zeta-Jones. I think she's just classic, old school, like movie star, femme fatale, just classic in a way that we don't really have anything that's like her anymore. Maybe sometimes Scarlett Johansson fits that same bill.
Mm-hmm. But, do you have a favorite Catherine Zeta-Jones performance, perhaps?
Moro is the first time I saw her, and I remember watching it in the theater and my breath just being taken away.
Yeah, she's so gorgeous in that.
Who was this beautiful woman on screen? And she, you know, in that movie, it's like the petticoats and the swords and the soft.
Yeah.
And then I think she's great in Chicago. She's so good.
We'll talk about that off mic.
We'll talk about that off mic. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Deladra. We really
I don't want to give away my thoughts on that.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.